On FM, we continue our Book of the Week, Cold Blood by Richard Kerridge. The acclaimed memoir charts several decades of the author's fascination with Britain's native reptiles. On a damp spring night, some movement in the road prompts Kerridge to slow down his car and then to stop as he realises what he's just run over. The reader is Robert Powell.
The dead toad seems huge, lying twisted on its side, head crushed into the road. A hand sticks up as if to fend off danger. I look away. But that one over there is alive, poised in mid-stride, a small female. The thin arms tell me that. When I loom over her, she shrinks, lowering her head and settling back onto her hind legs, trying to be small or to dig herself into the ground. Toads do this, holding their heads down and shutting their eyes with a wincing expression. If I wait and don't look, then the trouble will pass. She is cool to my hand and heavy. Females on their way to the ponds are plump with eggs. Gulps pulse through her body. She is damp. I feel her squirt water on my hand, as toads do when picked up. People take this for urine, but it is water that the skin lets into the body and the toad stores in its bladder, since amphibians do not drink. Lifting her up, I catch her earthy scent and see the bronze eye, delicately veined, with the black oval pupil. The eye that traditionally made people think there was a jewel inside the toad's head. Sometimes they killed toads looking for the jewel, expecting, perhaps, to find it in the red flesh, like a peach stone with shreds clinging to it. I contemplate my toad in the wet, yellow light. Her hind legs push hard at my hand, trying to launch her body from my grip. Headlights are coming up behind my car. My door is wide open in the middle of the road. I run back and slam it. The other car slows and stops. A young man gets out, his white T-shirt seeming to float in the darkness. I wait in his beams. "What's the trouble, mate?" "It's okay, I'm rescuing toads on the road." "Oh, can I see?" I show him the toad. I have my finger and thumb under her arms now. Her sides bulge against them. To seem bigger to a predator, she has filled herself with air. "Wicked," says the man. He grins in the yellow light. "Loads get squashed here. I see them all the time." "Uh-oh." Lights appear a long way off, coming towards us from the way our cars are facing. "Better check that side of the road," I say. The man follows. The beams of the approaching car pick out three or four corpses. "Is that a live one?" says the man, pointing to the edge of the road. We both hold up our hands and the car comes to a halt. I stride across. It's a male. I scoop him up and step back to the middle. We beckon the car on, and as it passes, I hold up a toad in each hand in explanation. My friend gives him a thumbs-up sign. "Can I hold it?" he asks. He cups his hands and I tip the male in. "Oh," he says. "Oh, whoops, he's peed on me." "It's water," I say. "They release it when frightened."
"Oh," he says, "no need to be frightened, little mate."
In the grass on the verge, we place the toads gently side by side, facing into the bottom of a hedge, to them a forest. They don't move.
"Are you sure this is the right side?"
says the man. "Yes," I say. "Yes, pretty sure."
"They won't think, shit, we're nearly across and he's taken us back to the start."
"No, I'm sure they were facing that way." He goes back to his car.
"Take it easy, mate," he calls, and slams the door.
Am I sure? Not completely. Perhaps they'll turn back to the road. Oh, I hope not. Common toads have mild faces. They seem calm. Their outlines are rounded and gentle. Nothing is sharp. The little bumps that hold their eyes look touchingly vulnerable, especially from behind. Lost in deep concentration, a toad looks easy to take by surprise. Their saggy bodies are awkward, and they run jerkily or make short jumps that almost tip them over, but they have, nonetheless, an air of portly dignity, frowning comically over the efforts they have to make. Fussily, they settle themselves. With what looks like patient rumination, they sit, watching the world, like elderly people in front gardens. All this is anthropomorphism, of course. I am interpreting the toad's face and posture as if it were a strange kind of small human being. The meanings I find in the animal's features probably tell me nothing that is true about the toad, though they do make me give the toad a lot of attention, which leads me to learn more about it. That mouth and those eyes do not really indicate that the toad is patient and mild. They evolved through utility and accident. I know that I am not really seeing signs of how the toad feels, or only to the extent that we share basic forms of bodily response even with a small amphibian, such as shrinking from danger or rushing forward aroused by appetite. How the toad sees me, I can barely imagine. I suppose it doesn't experience me as a single entity at all. It cannot see me whole. Toads have good eyesight. At night they can spot the movements of insects, slugs and worms 2 or 3 feet away. But of course, their field of vision is close to the ground. Movement is what catches their attention. Small movements, meaning food, and large movements, meaning danger. To the toad, I must be an earthquake, snatching it up, a wave of heat, or a hot, dry, confined space that descends around it. Lifted from the road by my hand, the toad might think it has been grabbed by a hawk's talons, except that the toad probably has no concept of hawk either. It cannot see the whole bird, just as on the road it cannot see the whole car. It has no angle from which to do so. Perhaps the toad never despairs. It does not see enough to know its plight. Anthropomorphism has its dangers, of course, not least to the animals themselves. I find toads likable, but there is a long tradition of associating them with evil. Sometimes toads were the devil in disguise. He appeared in toad form to be kissed on the lips by witches. Toads had a gothic, gargoyle-like quality. To the popular medieval Catholic mind and the later Puritan mind, the world was teeming with small demonic beings peering maliciously from the undergrowth. The migrations of toads through the fields must have seemed like the movements of goblin armies. Shakespeare's Othello, deceived into suspecting that his wife Desdemona has taken a lover, feels that his centre, the shyest part of him, his most sacred emotional place, has been defiled. An intruder has dirtied it. But there where I have garnered up my heart, where either I must live or bear no life, the fountain from the which my current runs or else dries up, to be discarded thence, or keep it as a cistern for foul toads to knot and gender in. When I first read these lines at school, I laughed aloud. I knew those foul toads. I saw the image. I knew what this knot was. Male toads congregate in the ponds in spring, squeaking rapidly, heads just above the water. Each is desperate to fix himself to a female's back. Hormones are surging, pheromones tugging. 5 or 6 males, squeaking in crescendo, converge on a female, grabbing at her from all sides. If a male is already on her, they try to force their heads in under him to prise him off. He kicks at them and tries to steer the female away, but 3 or 4 rival males have already taken hold. The female is overweighted now, and the knot of toads rolls over like a ball. More males arrive, as many as 10, clasping on where they can, arching their backs and squeezing tighter. They grapple and strain. The water boils with their struggle. She is buried at the center. Often she drowns. They squeeze the breath out of her and stop her from surfacing for air. Males in these frenzies grab anything. Sometimes frogs are pulled in, even fish. Once I tried to save the female. I had taken a small group of students, five or six of them aged 14 or 15, for a natural history ramble on a common that was popular with dog walkers. There was a pond at the bottom of a grassy crater, and we scrambled down the bank to see what life there might be among the brown reeds. Immediately I heard male toads squeaking, and pointed out a small group of them sitting on the pondweed. My students, hugging themselves in their coats, seemed unimpressed.
"I've got mud on me trainers," said one. "And me tights. Ow! My mum will kill me, sir." "What's that over there?"
said another. To one side of the pond, in deep water and dark weed, was a rolling ball of toads.
"What are they doing?"
I explained. A burst of squeaking came from the toads and the ball rolled towards us. Othello looks at the writhing knot with a horror that is different from mine. I fear for the female. He sees the toads as sexual appetite incarnate. This pure, brutal impulse terrifies and humiliates Othello. The absence of tenderness, shyness, or concern for others' feelings. Toads behaving like this are a disgusting, defiling presence.
"Oh, God, sir, can't we do something? I think you ought to make them stop, sir." "Yeah, sir."
"All right." I grinned nervously. "All right, I'll try." Leaning out across the pond, I used a stick to manoeuvre the ball towards me. It bobbed in the water. My hands were shocked by the cold, but I got them under the ball and felt the softness of the struggling bodies. In response to my touch, the toads bound themselves tighter. I lifted the whole writhing mass from the water and tumbled it onto the grass in a tumult of squeaking. I expected it to come apart out of the water, but none of the males would let go. My students had all gathered round. A greenish male was on top of the ball, his glistening skin quivering. I tried to get my finger under his gripping arm, but his arm was quite rigid. He gripped harder, his eyes disappearing under his cheeks with the effort. I was afraid of snapping his arm.
"What are you doing?"
At the top of the bank, a woman looked down at us. Beside her, a big dog pulled at the lead.
"I don't believe it,"
she said.
"You're trying to stop them. Leave them alone. It's natural."
"No," I said. "No, I'm trying to save the female. There are too many males on her. They could drown her."
"Really?"
she said suspiciously.
"Are you sure?"
"I've seen it happen."
"It's true,"
piped up one of the students.
"Yeah," she said.
"Well, can you get them off her?"
"I don't think I can. They are gripping too tightly. I'm afraid of hurting them."
"Better put them back then,"
she said firmly. She was right. I picked up the ball again. In my hands it struggled like a single creature. The students watched in silence. A toad's leg forced its way between my fingers. At least the female had probably taken some breaths. If I left the ball out of the water, crows would probably attack it. I placed it back into the pond.
Robert Powell was reading from Cold Blood by Richard Kerridge. It was abridged and produced by Jill Waters and is a Waters Company production for BBC Radio 4. Well, the government is opening up half the country to exploratory fracking. Would you welcome it in your area? Well, you can put a question to the head of the fracking firm Quadrilla on Call You and Yours just after midday. The number to call is 03 700 100 444. 03 700 100 444.
Glasgow, 2014.
And now it's game on then, the final half length in the pool here at Glasgow.
The bar on the shoulders, it's up, she's there, another huge grin.
A massive shock, oh my goodness, that is utterly brilliant.
Get all the action today, including the men's 110-metre hurdles final, tonight from 8 o'clock.
Can they hold on? Yes they can, they've got it, they've done it, it is double gold.
The Commonwealth Games, online, on TV and on BBC Radio.